Thank you all for joining us today. Derek Mulcahy, I lead Covington's Consumer Financial Services Practice, and I'm joined by my colleague David Stein, who has served with distinction at both the Fed and the CFPB. Our topic today is part of an ongoing financial services teleconference series called Taking Stock, the Financial Services and Regulatory Landscape Today. This is our 12th session in the weekly series, and there are additional sessions on small dollar lending and CARES Act updates in the coming week. We're very excited to be able to share this with you all, and so touch base with you even as the pandemic keeps us away from you personally. Before we start, we have a few housekeeping items to mention. If you'd like CLE credit, you can obtain it. Today's program is pre-approved for a half credit in both New York and California. Affirmation forms were linked to the reminder notice that you received for today's call. You'll need to record the affirmation code that we share towards the end of the call and return the form to our colleague, Elizabeth Christiani. Her information is on the form, and she'll revert with a certificate of attendance in due course. The other housekeeping item is that we welcome questions you have during the program or after the program. If you have questions during the program, please forward them to Al McManus at amcmanus@cov.com. That email address is also in the materials you have. And we'll try to answer those questions during the teleconference, but we're also very happy to connect with any of you on an individual basis following the presentation. Today is an update on what the CFPB has been up to, and it comes in three parts. First, David will talk about the Bureau's response or continuing response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Then David and I will talk a bit about other regulatory developments, the sort of business as usual part of the Bureau's activities over the last few months. And then we'll talk a bit about what the Bureau's been doing with enforcement actions and the pending Supreme Court case of CELA law, in which the constitutionally the Bureau is at issue. So with that, David, please take it away.
All right. Thank you, Eric, and thank you, everyone who's joined the call today. I'm going to cover this first section on the CFPB's COVID-19 response, and we're covering the period really since our last call, which was the beginning of April. So we'll be covering from the beginning of April to now. There have been quite a few developments, and we'll try to go through these fairly quickly at a high level because there's a lot of material to cover. One of the more recent issues, on June 4th, the Bureau and the Conference of State Bank Supervisors issued joint guidance on mortgage servicer forbearance. And among other things, that guidance provides that servicers may provide forbearance or offer forbearance for periods of less than 180 days with the consumer's consent. A day early before that, on June 3rd, the Bureau issued a statement that provided relief from the eSign Act consent requirements for credit card issuers. In particular, the Bureau was looking at situations where consumers request a temporary reduction in APR or fees on an existing credit card or seek to open a new credit card account. In those circumstances, the credit card issuer typically is required to provide written disclosures under Reg Z, although those disclosures may be provided electronically subject to compliance with the consumer consent provisions of the eSign Act. However, because the eSign Act consent provisions can be cumbersome and make it more difficult for consumers to obtain relief and open new accounts quickly, the statement provides that the Bureau will not take supervisory or enforcement action against credit card issuers who obtain oral consumer consent to the provision of electronic disclosures. But the Bureau did expect that credit card issuers would take reasonable steps to verify consumers' electronic contact information. So this is an important distinction, as the eSign Act, this is really overriding a longstanding statutory requirement. A few weeks earlier, on May 21st, the Bureau and their Office of Consumer Response issued a bulletin highlighting complaint trends, focusing on complaints during the months of March and April 2020. And during those months, the Bureau reported that it had received approximately 36,700 and 42,500 complaints, respectively, for each of those months, the highest complaint volumes in the Bureau's history. Many of those complaints, over 4,500, included specific coronavirus keywords, and common areas for these complaints were credits or loan deferrals stemming from recent statutes like the CARES Act that really had not yet been reflected in consumer accounts, difficulty reaching customer service, credit reporting, debt collection, and accessing proceeds from unemployment insurance. A few weeks before that, on May 13th, the Bureau issued a statement on supervision and enforcement practices regarding Reg Z billing error resolution timeframes in light of the pandemic. In the statement, the Bureau recognized that the pandemic had created significant operational disruptions for investigating potential billing errors, and indicated that it would take a flexible supervisory and enforcement approach regarding the timeframes within which credit card issuers need to complete those billing error investigations. Its focus was on ensuring that the creditor made good faith efforts to obtain necessary information and make a determination as quickly as possible without holding them to the strict timeframes. Back on May 6th, the CFPB issued a short set of FAQs to clarify how the Equal Credit Opportunity Act and Regulation B, and in particular the adverse action notice requirements, would apply to the Paycheck Protection Program. Under ECOA and Reg B, a creditor is generally required to provide an adverse action notice to an applicant within 30 days of receiving a completed application. And with the PPP loan application process, the applicant submits all the information, and then the creditor forwards it to SBA. And what was the experience that was happening was that SBA was not necessarily responding very promptly to those requests. So what the FAQs say is that a PPP loan application will only be considered complete when the loan has received a loan number from the SBA or when the creditor has received a response from the SBA regarding the availability of loans. What this meant was that, in the absence of this kind of clarification, I think some lenders may have taken the position that they had to give adverse action notices and decline applications when they were simply, awaiting action at SBA. On April 29th, the CFPB issued an interpretive rule that clarified that consumers have the ability to waive certain required waiting periods under the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act and under the Reg Z rescission rules in cases of a bona fide personal financial emergency. The provisions covered by this included the RESPA obligation to deliver a loan estimate 7 days before loan closing, a closing disclosure no later than 3 business days before loan closing, and under the rescission rules, the right to rescind a credit obligation secured by a principal dwelling 3 days from the date of consummation. The interpretive rule clarified that, based on a representation from the consumer of a bona fide personal financial emergency resulting from COVID-19, that would be sufficient to waive these periods. On April 13th, the CFPB issued an interpretive rule regarding pandemic relief payments made by government agencies. And the interpretive rule focused on the Electronic Fund Transfer Act and Regulation E, and in particular, its compulsory use prohibition, which generally prohibits requiring consumers to establish accounts at a particular financial institution as a condition of receiving electronic payments, including electronic payment of government benefits. The Bureau concluded that pandemic relief payments are not government benefits for the purposes of Reg E and thus were not subject to the compulsory use prohibition, provided that they were made these payments were made to assist consumers as a result of COVID-19, were not part of an already established government benefit program, were made on a one-time or otherwise limited basis, and were distributed without a requirement for consumers to apply for these funds. In practical terms, what this interpretive rule did was it allowed government agencies to distribute relief funds to consumers who did not have direct deposit information available via prepaid accounts. That's the practical implications of the rule. On April 10th, the CFPB issued a policy statement outlining its supervisory approach to the Reg E remittance transfer rule, indicating that it would not cite supervisory violations or initiate enforcement actions for transfer for remittance transfer providers who fail to disclose the exact cost of transfers rather than estimated costs. And we'll talk a little bit later about a rule that amplifies on that going forward. The last item I want to talk about is kind of at the sort of the bookends of this period. It deals with credit reporting guidance. And on April 1st, the Bureau released a policy statement that it would be taking a flexible supervisory and enforcement approach during the pandemic regarding compliance with the FCRA and Regulation V, taking into consideration a furnisher's individual circumstances and good faith efforts to comply with those requirements. In particular, the Bureau noted that it did not intend to cite a violation in an examination or bring an enforcement action against institutions making good faith efforts to investigate disputes as quickly as possible, even if the dispute investigations took longer than the statutory timeframes. Now, as a sort of a footnote to that April 1st statement, just yesterday afternoon, the Bureau issued some FAQs regarding that statement and made clear that it did not have unlimited patience with its flexibility. It made clear in particular that the statement, its prior statement, did not say that the Bureau would give furnishers or consumer reporting agencies an unlimited time beyond the statutory deadlines to investigate disputes before the Bureau would take supervisory or enforcement action. It also provided certain clarifications of particular obligations under the CARES Act and made clear that using certain special comment codes available from the CRA, the major CRAs, would not satisfy, were not a substitute for complying with the CARES Act reporting requirements. I think what this guidance suggests is that the state of the world in late March and early April was one thing, and sort of a lot of flexibility was required, but just like everybody else, consumer reporting agencies and furnishers are expected now 2.5 months later to be a little bit further along in their compliance. So with that, I want to turn it over to Eric for some pushback, to talk about some pushback that the Bureau has received.
Thanks very much, David. Yes, exactly. What the Bureau calls regulatory flexibility, Democrats on the Senate Banking Committee called steps to roll back protections for consumers during the pandemic. Shortly after some of the initiatives that David's described, the Democrats sent a letter criticizing the Bureau's efforts. It pointed to potential consumer harm from the Bureau's efforts to facilitate lending and reduce regulatory burdens. For example, the letter criticized Bureau guidance encouraging banks to make small dollar loans because that guidance did not include limitations on interest rates or required that the consumers be able to repay. More specifically, the Democrats faulted the Bureau for announcing that examiners would not hold furnishers of consumer credit information accountable for failing to meet statutory deadlines relating to disputes, as David described. I'm sure they feel the same way about the provision for oral consent to electronic disclosures. And we want to raise this not just because the Democrats and this current management of the CFPB see the world differently, but as a reminder that the Bureau's announcements do not change the law. And so if you decide to take advantage of the Bureau's flexibility, you should take into account that the law is still the law and there could be new leadership at the Bureau as early as 2021, a subject we'll return to later in the conversation. A couple other clues about what a new perspective on the pandemic might include. came from not only the Senate Democrats, but a white paper from former Director Richard Cordray. A few of those suggestions are illustrative. First, they say it is deceptive, unfair, or abusive to seize or garnish stimulus checks. It may be harassment under the FDCPA, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, to initiate new debt collection lawsuits during the pandemic. In particular, they would set down a marker that lenders that make any promises about payment shortfalls, for example, during the pandemic, had better be ready to follow through on those promises. So, again, we mention those words not because they're of significance in the short run, but they should be on your radar screen so that you know that your decisions pass muster not only under the current regime of regulatory flexibility, but that you will be they will also pass muster if an entirely new prism is used to view your conduct. Let me turn to what I call the business as usual section of our report. It's all the things that have been happening that one would expect to happen in the normal course, even if there wasn't a pandemic. One detail you should attend to is that LIBOR is going soon to be no more, and the Bureau has issued just very recently a series of steps to help with the transition away from the LIBOR benchmark. There's a notice of proposed rulemaking to amend Regulation Z to address the sunsetting of LIBOR, and you can read more about that in the written materials that came with this presentation. The Bureau has also released a group of documents to help consumers and regulated entities understand the transition, and I recommend them to you if LIBOR is within your charter. A second development is really not a development at all, which is that the payday lending rule, the revised rule that the Bureau has proposed in the year since Richard Cordray left, it seems to be in suspended animation for now. The Bureau had long planned to finalize its revised payday lending rule in April, but those plans were upended when, on April 29th, they were upended by a New York Times article in which an email from a career economist within the Bureau detailed sustained and pointed criticisms of the substance and process behind the proposed revisions to the Cordray-era rule. That article seems to have, and the blowback that was associated with it, seems to have stopped the rule in its tracks. It's not clear when the Bureau will issue its payday rule. We believe they still intend to issue the revised rule. In May, a Texas court hearing a challenge to the existing rule extended the stay of the rule and directed the parties to next report in on September 11th. So watch this space. There is some other news on the payday loan front or the small dollar lending front, which is that the Bureau gave approval to a proposed template for small dollar lending in late May. That approval was given to the Bank Policy Institute under one of the revisions in the no action letter policy, which allows trade associations to seek sort of template relief on behalf of their members. We're pleased to say we represented Covington and we'll be giving you a full presentation on this development next week. Suffice to say, it is a success for small dollar lending by depository institutions and a success for the new Bureau no action letter policy because it allowed BPI to take a step forward on behalf of all of BPI's members. And it also reflects a willingness by the Bureau that we had not seen before to include UDAP protection in the no action letter format. Previously, the Bureau had been loath to say that anything was not unfair or not deceptive or not abusive through a no action letter, and the Bureau has taken that step here. David, a couple other regulatory developments that you can cover?
Sure. Thanks, Eric. So one of another business as usual development was that on May 11th, the Bureau issued its long anticipated final rule on remittance transfers. The rule itself mandates that remittance transfers providers generally disclose the exact exchange rate, the exact amount of certain fees, and the amount expected to be delivered to the recipient. And the statute has, since its inception, has had a carve-out to allow estimates of fees and exchange rates in certain circumstances. The problem has been that these exceptions had a sunset provision of July 2020. In the final rule, the Bureau adopted two new permanent exceptions that do permit insured financial institutions to estimate, in one case, the exchange rate, and in the other case, the third-party fees, in certain limited circumstances. So in order to estimate the exchange rate for a remittance transfer, the recipient must receive funds in the country's local currency. The sending institution must be in a position where it cannot determine the exact exchange rate. The transfer must come from the sender's account at the institution other than a prepaid account, and the institution must have made 1,000 or fewer remittance transfers in the prior calendar year to that country. For the exception for estimates for third-party fees applies if the institution cannot determine the exact amount of third-party fees, the transfer is sent from the sender's account at the institution other than a prepaid account, and the institution made 500 or fewer remittance transfers to the designated recipient's financial institution in the prior year. In addition, the final rule increases the minimum threshold for coverage under the normal course of business safe harbor from 100 transfers annually up to 500 transfer or fewer transfers annually. The second development relates to the ongoing proposed rulemaking under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. On May 19th, the Bureau announced that it would provide an additional 60 days of public comment on its supplemental notice of proposed rulemaking on time-barred debt disclosures. So the original comment period was set to close on May 4th. It had been previously extended to June 5th, and now it's been extended once again to August 4th, 2020. So there's an opportunity still to comment on that rule. Back to you, Eric, for enforcement matters.
Thanks, David. So the Bureau does not want you to stop fearing the threat of enforcement actions. And so on May 8th, they posted a blog post saying that the pandemic has not undermined the Bureau's ability to bring enforcement actions and encouraging readers to report issues through the Bureau's online complaint process or, if applicable, the Bureau's whistleblower process. In terms of cases that were actually brought, in the interest of time, I won't summarize the cases themselves, but provide a general accounting for the Bureau's enforcement activities over the past few months. In general, it's fair to say, I think, that the Bureau is focused on smaller cases involving regional or local entities and obtained relatively modest relief. I would put this in baseball terms. I'd say the Bureau has decided to start hitting a bunch of singles instead of swinging for home runs. With the caution that there have been relatively few cases, I think it's fair to say that the Bureau's shift appears to have shifted. For example, UDAP is out and statutes are in. Recent cases are based on violations of the Truth in Lending Act or RESPA, the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And when UDAP is involved, it's most often used to allege deceptive conduct rather than unfair or abusive conduct. I think it's also fair to say, again, based on a limited number of cases, that civil monetary penalties are lower, both in general and as a percentage of the redress that's ordered. Of course, these are all the decided cases, so they've been in the Bureau pipeline for a while. I can give you anecdotally some of what we've been seeing from the Bureau. We do see continuing enforcement activity ranging from CIDs to NORA calls. And if there's a trend in the day-to-day work, it's that I think, again, based on just our experience, the line staff is taking more pains to prove their cases through the investigation. And I suspect this additional scrutiny means that cases are being given more scrutiny by supervisors at the Bureau. And so the staff wants to be more prepared than they had to be previously to present why a case is required. Or it may be that cases are not being authorized at the same rate. And so the staff is doing more work on the cases that they've succeeded in getting authorized. One other enforcement type issue is the pending CELA law Supreme Court case. As I'm sure everyone on this call knows, CELA law is a case that challenges the constitutionality of the Bureau, and in particular, the constitutionality of the Dodd-Frank Act language that requires that the president have a reason for terminating the CFPB director. The oral argument was on March 3rd, which means we're pretty close to getting a decision from the court. Before I describe what that decision might be, I want to be sure to read the CLE credit code, so anyone who has a hard stop at 12:30 is not out of luck. If this code is to be recorded in the remote attendee affirmation form, it's got to be lowercase x, capital M, 18. That's lowercase x, capital M, 18. Okay, just want to be sure you have that. Let me talk about the most likely outcomes before the Bureau at the Supreme Court. First, the court might decide it doesn't need to reach the constitutional issue at all. Paul Clement, who is arguing by appointment by the Supreme Court to defend the statute, made that argument. And all that would mean is it would be business as usual, except it would mean that it's possible that the case would be revived if a new president fired the current director. Second, the court could rule that the structure is constitutional, and that too would be a business as usual outcome. However, I think there's still a chance that there will be a new CFPB leader sometime in the next year or so, because after all, Director Kraninger's position in the litigation is that the president should have the ability to appoint the director, and so that would be an argument for her resignation. Third, the court might rule that the structure is unconstitutional because the director can't be fired for cause without cause, but sever that provision from the rest of the Title 10 and the rest of the Dodd-Frank Act. That's what then Judge Kavanaugh did when he heard the case in the D.C. Court of Appeals, and so that result would mean that the director could be fired, increasing the odds of, if there's a new president, there's a new director. But it need not void all that the Bureau's been doing. There's no particular reason to believe that the limitation on the president's authority to fire the director affected the work of the Bureau. Certainly didn't affect the work of Director Cordray when President Obama was in office, nor could you say it affected the ability of President Trump to fire Acting Director Mick Mulvaney or current Director Kathy Kraninger, both of whom acknowledged that that the president had that authority. And so there may not be big reverberations for that in the short run. There is this fourth possibility that the court could rule that director's appointment is unconstitutional and not severable, and so the Bureau itself is unconstitutional. That's the least likely of the outcomes. Brett Kavanaugh rejected that view when he decided the case below. And in light of time, if that happens, I promise you a new webinar that spells out the potential consequences. Even in this most extreme case, though, I would not expect a dismantling of the work done by the Bureau over the last 9 years. Now, that brings us to the top of the half hour. So I want to again mention that the CLE credit code is lowercase x, uppercase M, 18. That's X, capital M, 18. This is the 12th of our teleconference series. We're glad you all are staying with us, and that's why we've extended it a few more weeks. Next week, Jeremy Newell will lead a discussion about the no-action letter that the BPI obtained, and which has consequences for any institution that deals in or is thinking about dealing with small dollar loans. You'll also find additional information about this teleconference series on the events page of our website, which is at www.cov.com, and on a toolkit page we have on COVID-19. Links to both of them are included in the meeting materials. Again, thanks very much for joining us today. If you have any questions at all, please feel free to reach out to David or myself. We'll be more than happy to tell you more about any of these subjects. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, presenters. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. Thank you all for participating. You may now disconnect. Have a great day.